David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks, and welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 335. I'm your delinquent host, Steve Raker, resuming my post down in the comic book bunker after an unintended but much-needed month-long sabbatical at the end of the summer, where I spent my time camping up in the Adirondacks and chauffeuring my 15- and 10-year-olds to their respective football camps, practices, and now games. That old cliche about parents spending the equivalent of a part-time job taking their kids around to sports and other activities. I'm here to tell you, the struggle is real. That and the effects of all the busyness on my impaired head really kept me from being productive, even reading. But we are back here at Marvel Noise with a full slate of new episodes coming your way. I've got a lot I want to read and then share. Marvel Noise is an independent podcast proudly sponsored by nobody. We're grateful to be part of the Deliberate Noise Network, which hosts other great shows like Comic Book Noise, DC Noise, and Indie Comic Book Noise, which is our sister show that we, well, mostly Andrew, Kevin, and Phil, but I'm on there too sometimes, where we talk about the indie books that we've been digging. You can find new and archived episodes of Marvel Noise at marvelnoise.com, and wherever fine podcasts are streamed. But if you want the archived stuff, go to marvelnoise.com. There's a handy little drop-down menu on the right-hand side for past episodes. And we definitely have some good evergreen-type segments when we like to delve back to the old stuff. I'll be at the upcoming 20th anniversary 2019 Baltimore Comic Con that's taking place this coming October 18th, 19th, and 20th at the Inner Harbor's Baltimore Convention Center. This is a great comic-centric show that's become a must-not-miss convention for me each year. The guest list is always outstanding, the facility is plenty adequate, and the surrounding area is a nice, tight little tourist trap with plenty of options for food and drink right around the corner. I'll be there all 3 days with my pal Mike Spring from the After the Ending podcast. Check it out if you haven't yet. And you should be there too. Shoot me a message or tweet on social media if you're going, and we'll say hi on the con floor. Tickets are available for all 3 days, including the Ringo Award ceremony Saturday night, all online at the BaltimoreComicCon.com. See you in Baltimore. You can find Marvel Noise on the Marvel Noise website, on Facebook, and on Twitter at Marvel Noise. This episode, I'm joined by WWX Kevin and Andrew the LA Rabbit to talk about our recent reads, including the Hickman X books. And then Kevin and I will stomp through issues 13 through 22 of the Immortal Hulk series, which, quite frankly, are, dare I say it, incredible. But first, I want to continue to delve into the classic issues of Marvel Team-Up that I've been reading. I was originally thinking, who has the most appearances in Marvel Team-Up besides Spider-Man? You know, like, because he co-headlined the series, most of the issues at least, from the 70s and the 80s. So I tallied up the appearances and discovered that by far, it's been the Human Torch of the Fantastic Four. Next up was Iron Man, whose many appearances I covered 2 episodes ago on Marvel Noise episode 333. Between his episodes both with and without the Fantastic Four and Marvel Team-Up, the Human Torch has been in well over a dozen issues of the series, even headlining for a few issues, teamed up with whoever. And it makes sense, you know, the FF play nice with everybody, and since they've been around since the dawn of the Marvel Universe, they have relationships with and are respected by pretty much everybody too. It's no coincidence that the Torch's teammate, The Thing, starred in his own long-running series over roughly the same time period, Marvel 2-in-1. The Thing works well with everybody, as does Spider-Man, as does the Human Torch. The Fantastic Four and Spider-Man are the backbones of the Marvel Universe, after all. And I'll get into his headlining appearances, his later appearances, and his appearances alongside the FF in Marvel Team Up next episode, but this time around want to more closely take a look at the first three issues of Marvel Team Up, each of which starred Spider-Man and the Human Torch. And honestly, I think the title could have survived on this team-up alone every issue. I mean, Spidey and the Torch have such a history together, dating back to Amazing Spider-Man number 1, where Spidey ignorantly tries to join the Fantastic Four. And since then, they've been friends, rivals, friends again, teammates, heck, even roommates, right? Marvel Team-Up launched at the beginning of 1972. These first three issues are all on the Marvel Unlimited digital service, although they've also been reprinted in Marvel Masterworks hardcovers and in Essentials collections. Marvel Team-Up number 1 was written by Roy Thomas, with art by Ross Andrew and longtime Marvel Team-Up inker Mike Esposito, with a Gil Kane cover. Two of Marvel's mightiest in one mind-staggering mag, the cover read. This issue contains the tale, Have Yourself a Sandman Little Christmas, which I first read 2 years later when it was reprinted in Marvel's first oversized Treasury edition, December 1974's Marvel Holiday Grab Bag. It's Christmas Eve, and J. Jonah Jameson has Peter Parker covering the polar bears on Coney Island. The polar bears are... They're a club of swimmers that immerse themselves in frigid waters, although it's usually on New Year's Day, not Christmas Eve, but whatever. The swimmers are doing their thing when out from the ocean creeps a tentacle of sand that startles the swimmers on its way to the beach, where it takes on human form. It's the Sandman, you know, in his green armored duds with the mask and all. It's fun that he emerges from the ocean, too, where writer Roy Thomas had the Hulk dump him a year earlier over an Incredible Hulk 138. The police try to, you know, cuff him unsuccessfully. It's like cuffing sand, you know? Peter does the quick change routine and goes a few rounds with the Sandman as Spider-Man, until Spider-Man chides that the Sandman is the last guy he wants to be spending Christmas Eve with. The Sandman then gets a far-off, spacey look in his eyes and then says that he doesn't have time for any of this, and he splits, quite literally, into a billion grains of sand. Spidey heads over to the Baxter Building to get some help, although the truth is actually worse than that. As we've seen happen time and time again in issues of Marvel Team-Up, Peter often acts like he's never learned the lesson of Uncle Ben's death. Here, going to the Fantastic Four's headquarters to dump the Sandman problem on them. Far as I'm concerned, he's somebody else's headache now. He even justifies his actions by incorrectly citing that he's only fought the Sandman once before, but by 1972 it had been three times in Amazing Spider-Man 418 and Annual Number 1. Although he does correctly label Sandman as more of an Fantastic Four villain, as they had clashed in Fantastic Four 36, 38, 41, 42, 43, 57, 61, 94, and additionally the Torch fought him in a solo tale in Strange Tales 115, so by that time he actually had appeared way more times fighting the FF. But sorry, Spidey, it's Christmas Eve and no one's home there at the Baxter Building except for Johnny Storm, the Human Torch. He's there because he's heartbroken over losing his love, Crystal, who had to return to the remote, inhuman city, Atalan, after the industrial world's pollution was making her gravely ill. Spidey and Johnny go looking for the Sandman in the Fantastic Car, in an area that they've both encountered the Sandman in before. Along the way, they save a beautiful black woman from a couple of thugs. She shows the nabbed perp some Christmas Eve leniency, and although she's unnamed here, years later in Marvel Team-Up number 64, it would be revealed that this was the first appearance of Misty Knight, when she then recalls this encounter and thanks Spider-Man for his help in that later 1977 issue. Remember, this was the beginning of 1972. Our pair of heroes also stop a major cement truck accident from occurring before they conveniently spot the Sandman and engage him. Sandy sandstorms the Torch to snuff his flames and beats down Spidey pretty good. Then when they regroup and charge him, he turns into a cement-like wall and they both knock themselves out. Concussion protocol time. The duo awaken and they find themselves tied back to back, dropped in a full water tower, where only one can breathe at a time while the other is, like, submerged. Sandy wishes them both a Merry Christmas and splits the scene, leaving our heroes to rotate in the water for alternating breaths of air. But soon they manage to escape the death trap and chase down the Sandman, only to learn that he's visiting his elderly mother on Christmas Eve, as is his tradition. He offers to turn himself over to them if they just back off and give him a few minutes with her. It's also Sandman from the Spider-Man 3 movie, you know? Well, Spidey does Sandman one better and gives him a present that he'd been carrying to give to his Aunt May. And after time passes, the duo learn that they've been duped. The Sandman escaped down the drain. Oh well. Peace on Earth and goodwill to all men and all. You dig? We'll get him next time, they say. 2 months later, because it was initially a bi-monthly book, Marvel Team-Up number 2 hit the stands. Written by Jerry Conway this time, with art by Ross Andrew and Jim Mooney. There's a Gil Kane Romita Sr. cover showing our duo facing the frightful four. Well, three of the four. Medusa betrayed them and left them 2 years prior in Fantastic Four 94, and they've been looking for a new fourth member ever since. Marvel Team-Up number 2 takes place some weeks after the first issue. Johnny Storm is hanging out at night on the docks of the Hudson River, and he's approached by a drunk dock worker named Nathaniel. He calls himself by name twice, and the Torch calls him by name twice also. I mean, they really hit us over the head with the fact that this guy's name is Nathaniel. He gives Johnny a pep talk about how, like, it's a necessity these days to have good friends to lean on in this crazy world. And it's funny because Nathaniel would again appear in Marvel Team-Up number 13, which was written by Len Wein, not Jerry Conway, and he then gives Peter Parker advice on the docks. Well, with Nathaniel's words in mind, the Torch seeks out Spidey, who's swinging from the rooftops, and tries to strike up a more overt friendship with him. He makes a nice overture, but Spidey basically tells him to go fry salts and totally disses him. Coincidentally, when Spidey splits on the Torch, he draws the attention of the Frightful Four, well, three, who are holed up in what looks like the Wizard's not very well-furnished apartment. It seems like it's his bedroom, to be specific. You know, maybe his mom is home and they're up in the bedroom, but there's like a dresser with a comb and a brush on it. It's pretty funny. So it's the purple-helmeted Wizard and Trapster, and our adversary from last issue, the Sandman, who's all decked out in green like he didn't get the purple memo. I mean, even Madame Medusa had a purple color scheme. Still looking for a fourth member, the Wizard impulsively decides to recruit Spider-Man and attack the Fantastic Four's headquarters tonight. And sure enough, we next see Spidey coming knocking on the Fantastic Four's door, and Johnny leaps up when he sees it's Spidey, like it's like he's a teenage girl waiting by the phone and it just rang. But when Johnny opens the door, Spidey punches him in the face. Johnny's hit three more times before fighting back. How did the Wizard do it? How'd they recruit Spidey? Folks, it's not shown and never mentioned. It just is. Tsk, tsk, Mr. Conway. Spidey and the Torch tussle for a couple of pages until Spidey knocks Johnny out. Again with the concussion protocol. Johnny awakens encapsulated in the Trapster's hardened paste. Close enough to witness the Wizard and company fooling around with Reed Richards' patented portal to the negative zone, and sure enough, guess who shows up, riding a chunk of distortion zone debris like he's Doom on the Silver Surfer's board? That's right, it's Annihilus. Annihilus starts coming through the portal and growing in size, and the villains are freaking out. Johnny busts loose and tries to stop the three supervillains so he can get to Annihilus, but the Trapster has his number and proves far too much for him. Not really. Then the Wizard ordered Spider-Man to kill the Torch, and he gets in a few good shots in on Johnny before Johnny convinces him to fight it, whatever it is, and how he's a free man and all that. He keeps saying that. You're a free man. When Spidey's back to his senses, it's, pun intended, amazing. Spidey takes down the Frightful Four, well, three, you know what I mean, and defuses the Annihilus threat by essentially pulling the plug on the negative zone portal. Batteries not included. Annihilus is all, not when I was so close. I'm a ruler in my own world, and I'm beaten by a few children. Then Spidey splits and leaves the Torch behind to deal with the huge mess. What a jerk. So they never explain how Spidey was controlled by the wizard. But it's funny, because this issue reminds me that they'd almost try this stunt again years later when the Frightful Four captures Spider-Man in 1980's Peter Parker the Spectacular Spider-Man 42, and then they infiltrate and attack the Fantastic Four in the Baxter Building with the Trapster dressed as Spider-Man that same month in Fantastic Four 218. It takes the real Spidey escaping his bonds to save everybody, yet again. Marvel Team-Up issue number 3, in the spring of 1972, written by Conway with art by Andrew and Gayakoa, under a Gil Kane Vinnie Coletta cover, showing the Human Torch and Spider-Man confronted with Morbius, the living vampire. What's particularly neat about this is that this is only Morbius's second story appearance. He previously and first appeared in the now classic Amazing Spider-Man 101 and 102, in the previous fall of 1971, with this being the spring of 72. Those issues were the conclusion of the crazy six-armed Spider-Man saga that revolved around the effects on Spidey of blood transfusions from his adversaries the Lizard, as Dr. Kurt Connors, which caused him to grow the extra arms, and the blood of a pseudo-vampire, as the Comics Code Authority still wouldn't allow actual vampires, Dr. Michael Morbius, the living vampire. See what they did there? And his blood cures him of his additional appendage ailment. So at the end of Amazing 102, written by Roy Thomas, by the way, Morbius is flying through the city, dragging Spider-Man behind him, attached by a web line, and eventually Morbius smacks into an overpass and crashes into the river below and is never recovered. Dun dun dun. The opening scene of Marvel Team-Up 3 takes place a few weeks after that, under an overpass along the Harlem River, where two brothers are having a heated argument. They're brothers, but they're also brothers. You catch my drift? The older of the two, Jefferson Bolt, is telling his brother Jacob that he's conforming to the white man's world by going to college, and that street life is where it's at. When Jacob mentions Jefferson's gang-like associations, Jefferson punches him to the ground and storms off, only to spot a pale corpse floating in the river. Jefferson is all of a sudden some kind of altruistic humanitarian and just takes off his jacket and dives into the water to scoop the guy out. The guy, of course, is Morbius, who thanks Jefferson by feeding on him. Fast forward a few weeks to the then present, and we find Spider-Man dealing with episodic onsets of vertigo and flu-like symptoms, which knocks him from the sky while he's web-slinging and shakes him to the ground when he's wall-crawling. I mean, something isn't right with Spidey here. Meanwhile, Morbius's fiancée has gone to the Baxter Building to enlist Reed Richards' help to find and cure his fellow scientist, Dr. Michael Morbius, and recounts his origin to the Fantastic Four. The Torch remembers Spidey's version of the story and rushes out to find him, citing that it's time for another team-up. They find Morbius after he feeds and leaves another corpse on the ground there, and they engage and fight him. Spidey actually has to be pulled off of Morbius by the Torch. "You're gonna kill that guy!" And Spidey's all, "Well, he just killed that guy!" Spidey also has another poorly timed episode of illness, and he has to be pulled off of Morbius a second time in the same fight, this time by Jacob Bolt. "You're gonna kill that guy, Spider-Man." It's crazy, but in his early days, Morbius could, like a regular undead vampire, either kill a victim or sire other vampires with his bite. And Morbius had turned Jefferson Bolt into a vampire, which he enjoys being a little too much, if I do say so myself, and they've been hanging together for weeks since in Jefferson's crib while Morbius recuperated. Jefferson and his gang show up just as Spidey is shaking off Jacob, and the youths attack the two superheroes and actually have them pretty well contained, thanks to another mysterious fit of spider vertigo. Morbius uses this reprieve to try and feed upon poor Jacob, which doesn't sit well with Jefferson, who leaps at Morbius and is pushed away, his head hitting a rock and killing him. Spidey can barely move. Morbius escapes. The kids finally let the Torch go. And it's all just in time for them to witness Jacob mourn the loss of his brother for a second time. The issue ends there, but Spidey isn't having it. And in Marvel Team Up number 4, he recruits Professor X and the X-Men to help him apprehend Morbius. And it's a good thing, too, because it'll be another dose of Morbius' blood that'll cure Spidey of his unpredictable, debilitating illness. You can read all about it on the Marvel Unlimited digital service. All right. Enough from me. I'll cover the Human Torch's subsequent appearances in Marvel Team-Up next time, but let me get the guys on to talk about our recent reads. And the Immortal Hulk, you don't want to miss that. It's been far too long since we've made some noise together. All right, I'm here with Andrew, the LA Rabbit, and WWX Kevin, as promised, as featured on the playbill. What's up, guys?
Uncle Ben is back.
Oh, again? Is it the Uncle Ben?
Just kidding.
Is it like the Uncle Ben from Earth 2 who is still wandering the streets of New York, a happy man living out his life? Isn't there like a clone or something out there?
Oh, there was some weird nonsense, wasn't there?
I'm pretty sure. Maybe around the Gwen clone.
I have it. I have enjoyed his rice-based products.
I don't know if I would trust him to convert my rice, though. Like, from
convert
what?
From what? Exactly.
You and I have shared a meal together, obviously. What have you guys been reading? I feel like I haven't talked to you in a while since I was incommunicado camping up in the Adirondacks.
That's because we've been reading and almost weekly toward pace of too many indie comic books.
Hey, you guys are prolific, man. It's unbelievable.
I'm still reading Marvel.
Yeah, so am I.
Well, this is the place for that. This is Marvel noise. This is Marvel noise, as I used to say.
Well, there have been a slate of new titles coming out, as there always is at Marvel. I guess that's status quo. It's not like suddenly there's a launch of new number ones, but I've sampled a few. If any of you gents want to take a spin on the Andy's buying a lot of number one comics.
It's funny.
I bought a lot of number twos as well.
there's a number two joke in there somewhere. But
yeah, are any of those number ones also number twos?
Possibly.
It's funny though. For a while, the like slew of number ones was an event like in itself, right? Like here's the new non-event status quo banner for like this season of Marvel. Remember when they were kind of doing that and they were blasting like a whole bunch of number ones and then we were having fun trying to like keep up with the number ones for that year kind of thing? And now it really has just sort of with one event after another, it seems like there's just always a bunch of number ones that come out of each one, whether it's a Spider-Verse thing or a Thor thing or an Avengers thing or whatever. And they just keep coming, don't they?
Yeah, the Thor one was more, almost too much all-encompassing.
Well, I also like to point out that except for the event tie-ins, I think a lot of these are more envisioned to be limited series, even though they're not pitched as such. So I think it's just kind of, it seems like there's more than there is. I can't imagine some of these ones I'm going to mention, anyone's thinking they're going to run for 20, 30 issues or whatever.
It seems like that's the formula, though, right? Is like there's some sort of status quo changes or evolutions or developments of for a certain number of characters that are part of or shoehorned into the three times a year, it seems, events that go on, and then we're expected to have that, like, launch a bunch of new number ones, you know?
You know how you predict the long-running titles now? You go, is it a new or new reinvention of a character? Is it a character that someone hates? That book might go 50 issues.
Well, I also think that it has to do with where the character is going to be. Would it be something that would benefit having a relaunch? Although I love the relaunches where they don't really change much of anything, too. It's just a way to have a new number one.
See, I was trying to... I don't... Is that... Yeah, I guess so, right? Squirrel Girl, I guess there's enough Steve Ditko about it that you can give props and everything, and then that's your 50-issue book.
Yeah, I mean, I've only read the War of Realms. It's one of those books that I always enjoy when I read them, but I don't go out of my way to buy them. But I like that they put so much war, like they always have footnotes on every page, and they're really fun and enjoyable. There's only so much of like the kind of self-referential breaking the fourth wall type of stuff that I like in the book anyways, so I don't need it every month. It's sort of the same issue with Deadpool. I mean, the humor is a different style, but it's that same kind of like, hey, going to make clever jokes about the meta nature of the material.
I just think it's fun as a, you know, Monday morning armchair quarterback type, playing that sort of role that we do, is, you know, we see the rhythms and the patterns of sort of how Marvel does their thing, and I think we kind of had a sense of how things were working under Quesada and then under Alonso as the dynamic we were just describing. But now that Cebulski's been in charge, we're kind of, you know, it's been now, what, a couple of years, so we're starting to get a sense of we're starting to see what they want to be, how they want to do things, and it's interesting.
Yeah, I've been...
Not a criticism, just a passing observation.
I feel like some of it is also, and this is individual to my headspace, I feel like the kind of loop of everything, I'm still able to enjoy things even though I feel like they're very reminiscent. For instance, I'm finishing up, because I bought a lot of the different War of the Realms stuff, I'm sort of finishing up all those, and it was really fascinating how they gave... we all remember how they sort of retroactively created the Kull Asgardian god of fear a few years ago and used that event. Well, they gave him an ending in the War of Realms that just reminded me so much of what Simonson did with the Executioner.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed it, but it was just almost like, and then a lot of the elements just feel like I think you mentioned, Steve, how every 10 years or whatever, Thor has to have a Ragnarok, like,
that's kind of
storyline. It's kind of cooked in, yeah, how they, yeah. The title just natural, and I like them, but you do start to see the echoes and fingerprints of the earlier versions as you read the new ones. Like I said, still enjoy it, but it is weird that I get this real deja vu sometimes.
It's like a WrestleMania. It's like Ragnarok 37, Monday, Monday, Monday.
But I did go outside my regular comfort zone, and I picked up Death's Head number 1. Ooh. I don't know if either of you picked that up.
No, but I remember Death's Head back from when the Marvel UK books started appearing in, you know, on the shelves here at the direct, you know, market shops. I would say, what, in the late 80s, early 90s. And I remember the version of Death's Head when it was Death's Head 2. Which is more the design, I think, that they... actually, no, it was more of like a Predator knockoff in its design. But the artist was Liam Sharp, and it was the first time that I had seen his work, and I was blown away. It was cool stuff. I read it just for the Liam Sharp work.
I can see that. This is Teeny Howard, K. Zama, or Key, K-E-I, not sure how we're going with that, Philippe Sobrero. And it finds Death's Head in having been repurposed as band equipment, but he ends up getting his equipment rebooting. And then I unfortunately am very ignorant of his structure, but my understanding based on the tone of this is he's sort of Marvel's Lobo, like an intergalactic bounty hunter who's total kick-ass type. So he has it in for his former employer, and who turns him in, and that conflict ensues, and then it ends up eventually ensnaring, if you're fans of the Hulkling, and what was the, who's the, I apologize. My brain is completely shot. The his boyfriend, the magic guy.
Yeah.
The magician who used to be, who used to be Scarlet Witch and the Vision's kid, but I think that got retroactively undone, didn't it?
And then
I thought they weren't
that
anymore. Oh,
then they got redone again.
Okay. It's only fitting that it's the Scarlet Witch, given that her origin has flip-flopped enough times.
It's like Bob Dylan was Jewish, then he was like born again, then he was Jewish again. How do you keep
up? I'm like, how many times is Bova involved? Like, what are we doing with these characters? So they end up crossing paths with Death's Head, but Bova. I enjoyed that first issue, but Bova. I think I'm out on... That sort of paying homage to the 90s, I guess maybe late 80s, Lobo wasn't really a character that I dug, and that vibe didn't do much for me. But if you're into that and you feel that's what Death's Head is, I think this will be exactly what you're looking for. It's just not something I really need to keep up with. But it's a, you know, kinetic, fast-paced, lots of action. Like, you're not going to be bored. Fights, you know, the big fight with his old boss, and then another one with Wiccan and Hulkling. Is that?
Yeah.
At one time, at least.
That with the characters? I can't.
Not anymore. It's probably something else now, but.
They probably got a better name.
Yes. I would hope so. But if you like those characters, then this is a good setting. I feel everything's well done. It's just, hey, you know, not every comic is going to be to my aesthetic sensibilities or where my head's at.
Fair enough.
And then I have some other ones if you'd like as well.
Uh-huh. Keep them coming.
Quick.
Yeah.
I picked up in the wake of also recent events, we have new characters, Arrow. This is Arrow not as in A-R-R-O-W, but A-E-R-O.
Thank goodness.
This isn't a CW crossover. It's a Zoo Lifen Artist Kang adaption by Greg Pak. And yeah. Arrow and Wave, Origins and Destinies, Part 1. Writer Greg Pak, artist Pop Mahan. And Pop, I remember from that Master of the Universe tie-in. So we have two stories in the book. Kevin,
yeah,
you going to say
this,
something?
Andrew.
Oh, nice. So what did you think?
I think I enjoyed the first half more than the second half. It's not like this, like this, the more American-style back half, but... It was just interesting to see something adapted in the first. It had more of I guess it was more the art is more out there, and I find the backup story, the art is more like pedestrian. So
I just thought
it was more exciting, more stylized. And of course, a character that uses a wind, I'm like, I'm going to have to check this out. And it's like more of a, even though stuff happens, I thought it was more of a manga pacing type of thing.
Very, I would agree with that. And if Warwin had been in the book, I knew for sure you would have bought it. But she is a architect, and as Kevin said, she has wind power. So the first story is her going around her city defending it, but there's the building, she has to destroy one of the buildings that she designed, and it seems like there's, you know, it ends on a cliffhanger of a giant monster breaking through. And then the Greg Pak one ties into her connecting with the characters that we met in Agents of Atlas, where they debuted. Now, my only sad part about this is my favorite character from all that was the little girl that had the spirit bear.
Yeah.
And I wish she had gotten this here. I mean, not that I dislike that, but that was out of that whole crew. That was the one I liked the best. Cause I also picked up Swordmaster. Again.
Well, I don't want to spoil anything for you, Andrew, but something's coming up.
Yes, I would imagine she's... I hope she's getting a title, because I also, like I said, I picked up Swordmaster again, which is that split. So the first one is the Shizuhu with art by Gunji, adapted by Greg Pak.
God bless you.
The next one is Greg Pak and Ario Endito. And so I assume if Kevin read this, it would be the same thing, where the first one is an adaptation and feels very, again, it's that manga sensibilities and some of the stylistic tweaks that are known with that genre. Lots of, I think they were heavily influenced by Steve Ditko's Flop's Wedding. But I
as long as they have jobs, that's not like a cop, a lawyer, you know, a doctor. If you have different jobs, like an architect, that's cool.
That would be good. As long as they're dressed in full business attire. That's true. We demand. But both of these, so if you want to see what Marvel is going to do with adaptations of manga, these are two good examples. But I think it's weird that they have, like, also an American backup. I mean, not that I dislike one or the other, but it felt like a weird hedge.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, why don't you just go with one or the other? Like, giving us half a story of each. But as I've remarked before, while I used to like anthologies more, I feel like in our modern kind of decompressed days, you really don't get as much kind of the story when you split your story in half or a third or a quarter, which would get me to Fearless, which I also picked up, which was the same thing. Like, I liked some of the stories in them, but I feel like for the price point, I'm not getting a ton of book. You know, by the time you split it among all these, let's see, what were there, four stories in Fearless? Three stories. Campfire Song, Style High Club, and Unusual Suspects. Did you guys pick up Fearless?
I did.
No.
I'm so ready for comics to move to the less frequent, bigger objects, publications.
Other than graphic novels, I don't know if we can.
It works elsewhere.
Yes, that's such a different market, though.
Not to bring up the distinguished competition, but they have repackaged the original Walmart material in $5 books, which seems cheeky of them to take entirely reprint material for a pretty good price point. I bought one of them, but I'm going to stop because I feel like it's not. You're probably better off just tracking down the Walmart books given the price points on those.
Oh,
so there is a market for that.
Good luck there for me, Andrew.
Well, yeah, you're doomed up in Canada, but
yeah. But I'll say I also bought one of those Walmart comic reprint things, and it had really nice artwork.
I only bought a couple, but I always liked them. The Walmart books themselves, but the reprints, I was like, $5 a pop is pretty, it's smart for them because it's it's all free, right? I mean, other than whatever royalty they have to pay, but they're not paying for the creation of the content, so it seems like it's a good deal for them. But that's getting away from Fearless, which was a fun.
Yes, sorry about that.
No, it's good to have digress, because I liked the last one, which was the Kelly Thompson, Carmen Carnero, Tamara Bond villain, which was the silly, ended with a humorous end, but it was Elsa Bloodstone and Jessica Jones teaming up with Elsa Bloodstone. She was a character. She's part of the Bloodstone family, Kevin. I thought you said who.
I'm aware.
Oh, it sounded like you said who. And I was like,
no, door. it was a good ooh, because I like those characters teaming up. Yeah. That sounds like fun.
The first story, Campfire Song, Sean McGuire, Claire Rowe, Rachel Rosenberg, and then Style High Club, Leia Williams, Nina Vakuva, and Rachel Rosenberg. The first one, they're getting together prominent female heroes to give a talk at this weird school that no one knows any information about. It was a fine story, but the handful of pages didn't lure me in. I did enjoy somewhat the Millie the Model one.
Mm-hmm.
They had a paper doll in it. But the problem is, reading these kind of stories on this sort of paper with the kind of, I don't know, I like it when it's more throwbacky. I don't know. Maybe I'll just have to stick to my reprints on it. Like I said, I really like the last one. But I just feel that in the modern world, giving me these stories in like 9-page increments is not satisfying a read. I mean, I guess if I let it stack up or something, but on its own, I don't think I'm going to continue it because it was five. I mean, I don't know if issue two is $5, but these are $5 a piece, and I don't want to be accused of being cheap or anything, but $5 is real money.
Yep.
I'd take money.
Steve, did you have any take on it, or you not gotten
to
it
yet? I haven't read it yet.
Okay. I mean, like I said, it's enjoyable, but $5,
I hear that.
Got to cut ties where you can sometimes.
That's where I love that Marvel Unlimited. It, you know, once, you know, let's face it, we've been around a long time reading comics, and if you are able to tame the need for the urgency of that immediacy, of getting it first, getting it right then, I slowly became, as I've said many times on this show, a monthly buyer who reads like a trade waiter. I wait for arcs to be done or almost done. When there's like one issue left in the arc, then I like move it ahead in my to read box that it's like, okay, it's go time. Because there's so many different stories and things out there that you can forget what's going on or forget the momentum of a story, especially the way they were telling them for a while there, where each issue was clearly like chapter four of a six issue trade, you know. But that's just how I've been reading the books, and it's led me to not be as, you know, I get excited for the arc, but I don't start reading it till it's almost done. So, you know, I having the Marvel Unlimited has really been a nice tool for me, because my reading has shifted to be able to, there's enough out there that I'm behind on and need to catch up on that. I can wait.
I love the Unlimited, especially in light of the fact that so many of these series now might only be like 12 issues or in that ballpark. And I can sit on the Unlimited and rip through 12 issues of modern comics in a pretty, you know, it's not a daunting task or whatever, maybe two or three sessions or whatever, but you know, if it was 100 issues, obviously you wouldn't necessarily feel that way.
And the way that,
so I think the short runs lend itself to it.
Oh yeah. And the way that they've been releasing material on the Unlimited that seems to mirror like when they come out with another epic collection or another trade. Because they've remastered the material at that point, right? So it's like, this has been so much stuff lately. You see a good trade worth of stuff that's coming out, and it's like, sure enough, it pops up on Unlimited not too long after. It's great.
Yeah, I'm huge. So yeah, a lot of these I will be reading, you know, 2 years from now, Unlimited or when, or
and it's also
a catch up. Well, I just know, given how behind I am on other stuff. Plus, I do enjoy their events tab when they put an event together and the crossover books and everything. It's kind of, that makes it administratively convenient to read it for me.
There's no tab where Kevin tells you the proper reading the order, though.
You need to consult with that. They need to call you up.
Like a playlist. I need a playlist.
But my other throwback book, and I don't know if I'm going to keep up with it, is another one, History of the Marvel Universe, the Mark Waid, Javier Rodriguez with Alvaro Lopez.
Yeah, I was looking forward to this. You're not going to keep up with it?
And this, it feels like X-Men Grand Design ruined me for these books, I feel like.
Wow.
Like that was such a, and the Tom's Fantastic Four that's coming out. Like, I feel like the bar has been, like, if this came out 10 years ago, fine. Like, it's well competent, well executed, ties everything together. But I feel like those, the bar, like I said, has been raised. When you execute something that mind-bogglingly complicated and fun with just so much joy, it makes it hard for me to sit through these other ones. The other thing about the first issue I was less into is, I don't always like it when they neatly tie everything together in the Marvel cosmology.
Yeah.
Like, I'm okay with, like, the little things, but trying to explain Eternity in a rational way and, like, who came first and how they were created feels a little bit, I don't want to say dumbing down, but it just feels weird to put those things kind of ranked. It's almost like you'd never have an Ohapmu on that. You know what I mean? What would you say? Except like unlimited strength, unlimited intelligence.
Seven, yeah. Those cards, right?
Yeah. So in the first issue has all that stuff about how, you know, Galactus was from the old universe, and then the energy that created the Infinity Stones and And I don't know, just having all that stuff together, I guess it's maybe not my jam as much. But I like when they get more into it, and they have a big annotation section, which is nice. Like I said, well done. I just feel like X-Men Grand Design, not to harp on that book, I've talked about it a lot, but I really think it's really well done. And I'm excited for the Fantastic Four one.
Me too. I mean, there's a way you can do that History of the Marvel Universe stuff without it being a competition with those type of book. Like, do you remember the old backups in the first volume of What If that were the Mark Gruenwald, I think they might have even been titled History of the Marvel Universe at that time, but there'd be one issue that, and it was, you know, those, that first series of the What Ifs were extra-sized issues, and sometimes the story didn't take up all of those extra pages, and they'd throw the backup stuff in there. But, you know, one time it would be a thing about Galactus, or a thing about the Celestials, or one story would just be, like, about some cavemen, and you wouldn't even know where it was going until, like, you realized, oh, this is, like, where the Deviants came from, or some type of thing, or here's the High Evolutionary, or it was just very clever the way they did it in these short little reference tales, and I enjoyed that way of going about it, and they could have done something along those lines where they're telling little stories from different important moments in the Marvel Universe, but I'll still give it a shot. I mean, it's Wade, right? So he knows his stuff.
Yeah. Oh, you should definitely, but it just reading like each one gets a panel, like, okay, then the the Celestials show up and they're intervening, and then the next panel, it immediately talks about the Watchers, and just having all that stuff kind of like bam, bam, almost like a checklist or something isn't, like I said, it's well done and everything's good. It's just not how I want. I like almost keeping those things somewhat compartmentalized. It feels, it also frees up the artistic team to be like, you know what, this time we want this character, this, they're not even really characters half the time. They're like embodiments of universal energies or whatever to act in a certain way. And I feel sometimes this sort of a little too big out puts them in a box. But totally. I have the first couple issues, and yeah. I don't know.
I mean, it almost sounds like a movie executive needing to know like all of the details, like, well, how does that work? And it's like, well, it doesn't matter how that works to the story. Like, we're just trying to tell a story here. And it's like, well, no, it's a,
that's a good, yes. It feels like cliff notes for someone who's like, okay, I need to just cram. I just got hired by Disney. Like, what's this?
Yeah.
Here's five issues where it'll give you from. And I don't know. I just feel having such a strict, like, this guy came and then this guy came, when it's the big epic aliens and powers of the universe. I don't know.
Well, and you know, the Distinguished Competition did this a few decades ago with Wolfman or Ween did that limited series that was like a history of the DC universe. Was it as simple as that? Or it was something along those lines.
Yeah, it was like a square bound with cardboard covers, I seem to remember.
And they reprinted that not too long ago. But again, it was an attempt at making a narrative while also sort of making a reference of the history of the... Gosh, I wouldn't even want to try with that universe because they've restarted it so many times. But yeah. Interesting. Well, I'm definitely going to check it out, but it doesn't sound like it's a good reading experience as much as it'll just be a nice nostalgic flip through. Because one panel to the reader means, you know, several issues to us, right? So
yes. Oh, entire series in a way, you know. But I think I'll be interested in your thoughts. Maybe I'm just too nitpicky on her. I'm always like pushback when I get to things, so I'll see. In fact, I'm going to save Ghost Spider number one for when Kevin reads it.
Oh, nice.
I know he's a big Ghost Spider guy.
And another 50-issue series. Go Ghost Spider.
And it feels like it, from what I can tell, it's not a radical... I mean, it's a slightly new status quo, but it's not like they're blowing up the character in any significant way, but maybe Kevin will be like, hell no. It's entirely ruined. How dare you? I'm never talking to you again type of level.
Well, but at least it looks nice.
I do owe Kevin because he cost me some money because I had to go buy a back issue. I was at a store flipping through the back issues, and oh, this is one Kevin said I had to get. So
in dive
that I did not have. Do you have any guess which one I got, Kevin?
Is it New Warriors related?
No.
Ah.
What's our main project? Is it
Thunderbolts related?
Yes, it's Thunderbolts related.
Okay. Who don't you have?
Yeah, yeah. This is second tier Thunderbolts. You dog, you. I'm going to use stronger language, and then remember, this is Marvel noise. I want to save Steve that edit button. It's a Tales to Astonish book, Kevin.
So it's like The Fixer or someone?
Tales to Astonish 81, the debut of a superior foe of Spider-Man.
Who was in 81? Wasn't like Boomerang or something?
It was Boomerang.
Ah.
Ding, ding. I saw that was on your list of must-have back issues. So I saw it stock for a decent price, and I was like, you know what? That's not bad at all. I mean, it's not like gem mint condition or whatever, but I can add the Boomerang first appearance to my Thunderbolts collection. So curse you, Kevin.
That's pretty good.
Well, they also had yet another one of the first appearance of Melissa screaming Mimi, but I have so many of them.
Wow, Robin, why don't you?
I got a drawer full of those.
And I was like, do I really need like another really beat up copy of that?
Andrew's just like, oh, that's a common drawer.
But it was a good store to have. Like, out here, they don't have a lot that have back issues in stock. So when I find one that does, it's really fun to go through because they're just, I get it, real estate's expensive here, and, you know, per square foot, it's hard to keep a bunch of back issues in stock that aren't all just keys or expensive or whatever. So whenever I find these books, I try and pick them up because they're never, like, they're like $20 or less usually. So I'm not getting gem mints or whatever, obviously, at that price when it's like $8.50 or whatever. But hey, it's a copy, right?
Sure.
But I blame Kevin. I will also say, if you are in Florida or Southern California, the Star Wars Galaxy Edge book, they're up to issue 4 of the series, is a lot of fun because it's set in the land that they built in the parks.
Of course
it is. Disney built a Star Wars land. So it's kind of fun to read a story set, you know, in the, like, cantina that you can now go into and the little stores that you can go in. So it's just fun. I don't know if you don't have that connection, if it's quite as much fun, but I'm really enjoying it, and I think 5 is the last issue. So I kept up with that. Then I got some other stuff, but I thought I could just end with something we've all been enjoying, and that's the Hickman X books. I'm still grooving on it. I really think if you only had to pick one issue to hook you, I would say House of X 2
really
is the one that
really
is then the hook for me. Yeah.
I've heard both sides. Like, I've heard like the story doesn't have momentum since he placed this so early on, but I've also heard, oh, that's so awesome as a done in one sort of thing. It's connected, but it's not like it's its own thing.
Well, very minor spoilers. The story has separate timelines that interrelate. So there's a lot of many of the issues have jump between the different timelines. So I do like that that's all more consistent than, although the most recent one as of the time of this airing also stays in one timeline, Powers of X 3. So that was enjoyable too. But, and I don't mind the jumping around so much, but Hickman always have such layers. I'm kind of curious when it's all done, if they'll be like, maybe I'll just read like each timeline sections, you know, or do different edits like that. Because I'm always curious, like, obviously he's deciding when to show which timeline, and they're interrelated, so that drives some of it. But some of it's also just, we're going to spend more time in this one.
It sure facilitates and puts more importance on the text pieces when they're in there, right? Because he uses the text pieces much more effectively than back when he was doing the Fantastic Four book. There were stories that didn't really quite finish, and the text piece was at the end of the book and would tell you what happened next. And it's like, well, that's cool. I kind of wanted to see what happens next. I thought that's what next issue was for, you know? And here, because he's dealing in these different timelines, you're getting these text pieces that explain the history. You're getting a historical archive, a look into that, an entry in a historical archive that explains a bunch of stuff that happened in between. And sure, would you like to see a comic that did all that, but he's talking about like 100 years worth of stuff. You know, you need to get some blasts of information, and I think that's a great way of using something that a device he was already trying to use and in his writing, and using it more effectively and to his strength here. That's cool.
I needed it. I'm a dummy, and some of it I didn't get, and so I'm glad, because some of that I really... I found it to be, like a lot of his stuff, really dense, so I'm glad he put... Because some of it I was just like, particularly that one issue I said, I read the beginning a few times because it was a part of it I wasn't understanding. But by the time I got to the back, I'm like, oh, it just clicked in. But without some of those pieces, I'm probably missing a lot, and I do use them as reference sometimes. You know, I'll flip back because it describes who character... And I just think that, like I said... Might be I'm just really stupid, but I'm glad those things are in there. They're really helping me get more out of the story. And like I said, I'm sure when you read it all and then I'll do another reread, it'll make, you know, once it's a complete story and you go back the second time, it'll make more behind. I need that stuff, and I think it's well done. And the charts and graphs, which I'm normally kind of like, I don't care. These ones, they convey so much information quickly. Yeah.
Because this issue that you're talking about, the House of X2, this is the one that was the Moira MacTaggert issue, right?
Yes. Yeah. And I did not get the gist of it in the beginning.
I had a real love-hate relationship with this issue because it was done really well, and you know what he was saying was kind of cool, but I don't like this character, MacTaggert. She's been around for all this Claremont era, and she had like two jobs for the X-Men story. She had two roles to fill, and she filled them well. One, she was a means to an X-Men villain for a couple of issues, that Xavier had a hidden son with her, and it was the Proteus guy or whatever, right? Or it was hinted that it was Xavier, but it was the other guy. But then, no, they really did have a son later on. It was Legion. But the Proteus villain, so to have that relationship with Charles from his early days in the Academy and all that. But the other more important role was just so that she had Muir Island, just so that there was a research medical center that they could go to get, you know, technology and to get some information and data before they had the caveat of saying that everything was just a gift of Shi'ar technology that they had around the X-Mansion, you know? This was the place where they went to get the cutting-edge study, what's going on with the Phoenix's power levels, why can't the Iceman de-ice, or whatever the problem of the day was, right? That's where the injured mutants would go to convalesce and to recuperate and rehab and that kind of stuff. And then after that role, everything just got crazy. I mean, didn't she die and come back, and she was anti-mutant, and she was pro-mutant, and how many kids has she had? And it's just, the character's a hot mess. And was this the first time they're revealing that she was a mutant, or has she been a mutant before this?
This is the first time I'm aware of.
Yeah, first time.
Really wild.
I would add a third purpose, Steve. That was to let them do their lovely phonetic Scottish slang.
Oh, God. So Banshee would have somebody to talk to.
Exactly. Banshee was the Irish. She was the Scottish. Kurt Wagner was German. You know, they had to have those, I'm not going to say stereotypes, but they had to have those phonetic shortcuts that we all loved.
When Banshee's scream was injured and he was hanging out there for a really long time and it was like never going to come back, and they sort of had their romance, that should have been the two of them riding off into the sunset, and we never should have heard from either of them ever again.
I wonder, wow. The letterer must have hated doing those. I always got to think, I didn't know what you mean. You know what I mean? Just having to not. But I enjoyed, it was a clever idea, well executed. I totally see if this is your favorite character, you might be like, hey, I don't like all this sort of explaining in this way to view the character. But because I didn't, I mean, she was fine, but it wasn't like she was my favorite ex-supporting character ever. I thought it was such a clever, fun take that I was fine with the, I don't know if you call it a change or like a new revisioning, or I don't really think it's a retconning so much. It is somewhat, I guess, but like you say, they don't really, I don't know, I guess it is a retcon.
Yeah, technically I think it is, but usually that has more negative connotations, I think.
And the mutant power itself is like, you know, it's really a reality warping type of a power more than a reincarnation type of a thing, because everyone else goes back to square one too. Yes. When she does. So that's really, it's,
that was the concept I didn't understand in the beginning.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways she's the most powerful mutant ever.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's such a wait, what, you're reading it and then you're like, I think it helps if you know or have some idea in the back of your brain that something is occurring. Because if this is your first story, you'll be totally oblivious to what is happening, right?
I'm just going to pick the edges of my skirt up so they don't get wet or muddy on the ground as I skip through and just move along, because there's a story that is being told and I don't want to get stuck on that. You know what I mean?
But I want to say that if you don't have, it's really well told.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Put aside your feelings for the character. That's what, because I had this on my bed and the cover alone drew my wife in. She's reading the big omnibus you wanted to read, The Death of Phoenix and Tales of Future Past and all
that.
Fun. But the cover alone, you know, of all the different Moiras really got her and she started reading it right away. So I think it's like I said, you may object to the retconning nature, but its execution, I don't think you can poke too many sticks at.
You know, the maps and charts and graphs are like the modern age cutaways. That's what I'm going with now.
Yeah. Yep.
Pretty cool.
Very cool.
So I got more books. If you want to hear about more books.
Oh. Yeah, what do we got?
I got some number twos.
You've heard about the number ones.
Well, I threatened you with the number twos, I believe.
I have, which ones? I have some number twos.
I have Black Cat.
Yeah, I read Black Cat number two.
This was by Jed McKay, who I guess I'm slowly getting used to as a new writer at Marvel and saying, hey, there's some good stuff here. Like sometimes, like you're not necessarily buying on the creator's name. You're like, oh, that's a cool character or concept, and then you sort of see how these guys do things, and you're like, is that someone to follow? Like I remember they wrote that Daredevil 5-issue thing where he was just lying in bed all day, and he was like, I can't do anything, and that wasn't really my thing.
Yeah,
but so then I'm like. But it's Black Cat, right? So I'm like, I'm happy to say this is I enjoy this way more than Daredevil.
Well, Black Cat lying in bed all day is a different adventure.
Art is by Trevor Foreman and Ryan Reaver. So yeah, Black Cat having a crew doing a cool heist. And then like Black Fox and characters like that showing up, way more my thing. Way cooler.
I like that she's got a crew.
Like you go to some cool locale in the Marvel Universe, and I'm like, yeah, we're gonna do something here. So that was pretty enjoyable. And then the thing that's sort of the other thing I should say, because that House of X issue kind of blew my mind. And then Silver Surfer Black number two, the art just completely blows my mind. Everything that's going on in that book. Like the colors, the renditions of everything, the designs, just everything that's going on. I'm like, even if this story was terrible, it isn't. But even if the story was terrible, I'd probably still just buy it and just look at it. Like it is ridiculous. I don't remember if we spoiled who the big bad was in here.
No,
but he's drawn in a certain way that I'm sure some... Like, last time he was drawn really, like, serious and spooky. And in here he's, I don't know, so, like, flowy and...
Flowy.
Not more grotesque, but he looks so different. So cartoony, so larger than life. That it is, I'm sure, like, that people would have a reaction to, because I have a reaction to, and I still have trouble, even though he looks great, I have trouble, like, reconciling that image. Like, out of anything in here, like, all the other stuff, I'm like, that's great, that's cool, like, awesome stuff is going on. And I see him, and it's like a mental thought process, where you're, like, processing his visual. So the surfer is basically, he's in this other world, and he's fighting some stuff. There's not, like, a whole massive thing to it, but it's really cool to look at and see what happens to the surfer as he's just trying some stuff out, and maybe stuff is happening to him. Because it is Silver Surfer Black, and one of his hands is black.
No!
And then someone really cool shows up at the end.
All right. I'll read the book already. Or at least look at the pictures.
That's all I ask, Steve. Just look at the pictures. Look at that noodling. Look at all that. All that detail. Oh, so much. So good. Oh, yeah. I get... This is the important part. By Trad Moore and written by Johnny Case. And Dave Stewart on colors.
Any others, or are we...
Well, this isn't a two, and I already talked about it last time, so I don't know if I should make a brief mention to White Rabbit showing up in Amazing Spider-Man 27. and a new Trapster.
Oi.
Oh, and it's Trapster, but with a little, like, a letter missing. Because this is, like, the new, not the Sinister Syndicate, but just the Syndicate. They're ripping off names left and right. It's great.
Next thing you'll tell me is that it's a girl.
Total girl team. and Boomerang is such an idiot. But that's why you love Boomerang, right?
It's true.
So much fun.
Hey, I have his first appearance. I don't know if you heard.
All right. I gotta talk to the Hulk, about the Hulk with you.
Insert the Smash Tales.
Oh yeah,
theme
totally.
Music here.
And the bullets. And Kevin and I are back. We have been spending our days safely and our evenings with the Immortal Hulk, catching up on that book. And I got to say, this book has gotten a lot of accolades, and rightly so.
Book of the year?
Phew. It totally lives up to the billing. It has not fallen into the trap of enjoying the popular status quo and stretching it out, but continually changing things and keeping the horror quotient and grotesque quotient pretty high, I would say. This is The Immortal Hulk by writer Al Ewing, with art for the most part by Joe Bennett. We talked about the first chunk of issues back in December 2018 on Marvel Noise episode 323. But I think I am started reading a few days ago issue 13, and the series is up to issue 22. So I enjoyed having a chunk of issues to delve through and to be able to sort of sit back and try to get a sense of what this series is and continues to be.
Oh, it lulls you into a false sense of security, and then whammo!
What's hard about picking it up after not reading it for a little while is that there is no like preview page. There's no like previously in the Hulk or whatever. There's just these like creepy quotes from literature, you know, and then it's you're on your own. Fortunately, though, Al Ewing does answer letters in the correspondence page that is usually two or sometimes even three pages long at the end of the book. So you get some sense of that, you know, connection with the editorial or writing team where they get to kind of tell you what's elaborate on what's going on, I should say, because there's always a lot going on, Kevin.
There is. And there's always, like, old favorites and weird combinations and...
I don't know how long ago it was that you read back to where I started reading from on issue 13, but I'll bring you up to speed and remind you that that's when they were finishing up the big arc that involved the Absorbing Man, who sapped a bunch of gamma from the Hulk. And in the process, we learn that gamma has or is just as much a magical phenomenon as it is a scientific phenomenon, right?
Yeah.
The gamma takes form as Bruce Banner's like abusive father. And then there's this whole giant gamma beast from below and a portal scenario. And it's all very Stranger Things. The Hulk, too, he's emaciated. He's going around like half gamma powered. And so he's all deformed for a few issues. But he gets made whole in the finale thanks to a heroic act from the Absorbing Man.
And you have the people with no eyeballs.
Issues 14 and 15 deal with the fallout from the Captain America title, actually. Issue 14 has Bruce and Betty being reunited and features the yet again funeral of Thaddeus Thunderbolt Ross, who died in all places over in the Captain America title.
Yeah, whenever they reference that book, I'm always like, maybe I should check that out. But I hear it's a slow burn.
And it was one out of two. You're right on half of that. but thank goodness this issue is drawn by Kyle Hotz as a guest artist. And, oh, man, it's just awesome. It's like bordering on Bernie Wright's in, you know, nighttime creepy scenes and people having these over-exaggerated facial expressions. And
yeah, he's perfect for the book, too.
Issue 15 has the Hulk being psychoanalyzed by Doc Samson.
Who else?
And addresses how the Hulk had been used by Hydra Cap in last year's Secret Empire event, where Hydra Cap took over the country and they had this mindless Hulk as one of their weapons. Yep, Doc Samson's back from the dead again. And
Gamma.
Right. He explores where he's been and the nature. You know, he wants to know what the current nature of this Hulk is, and why do all these gamma beings keep coming back from the dead? It's not just a comic book contrivance, is what Samson's saying here. Like Rick Jones, who was killed at the end of Secret Empire by a firing squad, but here we see that his grave has been robbed, so we figure he's going to get brought back from the dead, too. And Kevin, the graveyard that he's buried in, it was the J&M Severin Memorial Cemetery. Kind of cool.
Yeah. It wasn't the black cat robbing the grave, either.
This was a mess. No, she would have done it much cleaner. This one was messy. Issue 16 has the Hulk and Samson storming General Fortean's covert base. That base was where the Hulk was. Remember, he was dissected and kept in all the mason jars and everything several issues ago. But it's a trap. And Fortean, who was, you know, he's like the main bad guy who's the head of this shadow military strike force that is after the Hulk and really don't care if there's collateral damage. If humans are getting killed, that's just fine with Fortean. And he is like a protege of Thaddeus Thunderbolt Ross. And the trap that he sets for the Hulk is that a bunch of like UV light, because this version of the Hulk goes back to the original incarnation of the Hulk, where he became the Hulk at night and not during the day. So a bunch of UV light turns him back into Banner, because they make it daytime underground, basically. But this Banner has Joe Fixit's personality.
That's so cool.
Joe Fixit was the Gray Hulk, who was a enforcer, like a bouncer at a casino during Peter David's run way back in the early 90s or late 80s. In issue 17, Banner is wounded, but he's still got the Joe Fixit personality, so that's like going to be his means to survival. And he's on the run from this vicious cyborg soldier guy who has an axe to grind with Banner.
I don't know if that's literally or not.
Yeah, he can make his arm into any weapon, whether it's a gun or an axe. He could literally grind Banner with an axe. He would probably like to, too. He wants to toy with him. And meanwhile, Rick's corpse is soaked in this gamma-radiated DNA from the corpse of Emil Blonsky, who was the Abomination. And they create... Remember when Rick was the Abomination and he, like...
A-bomb.
He was so... Yeah, he was so cool and hip, and he loved being, like, he was, like, trendy. Like, I'm going to be A-bomb, not the Abomination, because I'm so hip. I'm Rick, you know? Not this time.
I'm Rick.
This time, it's this new, horrific Abomination that they create.
Oh, man, it's like nightmare fuel.
And also very Stranger Things. Issues 18 to 20 have this new Abomination confronting the Hulk and really mopping the floor with him, because he's got like this acid that he can regurgitate and throw up on the Hulk, and it eats away at the Hulk's flesh, and the Hulk doesn't regenerate. I mean, he's like a quadriplegic laying there. Like a quadruple amputee. It's horrible.
And you're like, well, that's it for the Hulk. Again.
But fortunately, there is a savior on the way in the form of Betty Ross herself. She was shot in the head, dead, back in issue 14, the Thunderbolt Ross funeral episode or issue, and she's transformed and into this red harpy-like creature.
What?
And this has happened before, Kevin. As soon as I saw this harpy, I'm like, oh my gosh, and I had to flip open my comic program and flip back through all those Hulk, like the Herb Trimpe era of Hulk. I'm like, I know it's in here somewhere. So he fought a harpy that looked just like this but was green. And I think I remember it was Betty. Or am I confusing it with, like, Alicia in, like, a Marvel 2-in-1 becoming a spider-like creature? Which
I'm pretty sure it was Betty.
But, no, the Alicia thing happened, too. But I just wasn't sure if this happened as well, you know?
Yeah.
And I look it up, and sure enough, Hulk 168, Englehart, Trimpe, and Jack Abel, MODOK turns Betty, at that time Betty Talbot, into a green harpy-like being who looks just like this harpy, but green, and now she's red, because remember, this Betty was the red She-Hulk for a while? What a cool nod to continuity and everything, right?
There's so many, like, there really should be, like, some footnotes on the letters page. Like, you might think, oh, that's cool or whatever, but I don't know if everyone knows how many.
But you don't...
Like, it's not... necessary, but there's a lot there.
You don't need to know that she's manifested with gamma radiation into this form before, because really for the story, all you need to know that she's transformed into a horrific gamma being. And everyone's transforming into a new type of gamma being. You know, even the Hulk, even though he still looks like the Hulk, he's a new type of Hulk, right?
Yeah.
And the way these gamma beings encounter each other and relate to each other. It reminds me of like giant kaiju like coming apart, coming upon each other, and like, yeah, are they going to fight? Do the humans, the soldiers who are gathered around, let them try to take each other out, or do they try to set them off against each other, or do they intervene? It's all very Godzilla to me. But she joins the scene, and at the end of 19, and it's really strange, she rips the Hulk's heart out and then, like, eats it.
And then I had to wait.
The quadruple amputee one.
I know. I was like, what is going on?
Crazy. There is a thing, a theory for healing. One of the techniques is called prolotherapy, where you'll take like a injured joint or muscle or tendon, that kind of thing, and after it's already maxed out on its healing but you still have problems with it, you try to kickstart the healing by introducing a micro trauma. So you inject just some like salt water, some saline solution into the joint with a needle, and it kind of fools the joint into thinking that it's been injured and is supposed to kickstart the natural healing processes that have all sort of run their course otherwise. And that's sort of what happens here by Betty munching on and basically killing this Hulk. It kickstarts his regeneration process and he's born anew. But from what? He just kind of pops up, and I was like, did he come out of the old corpse? Did he just come out from like under some rubble? Where did he come from? Issues 21 and 22 give us the backstory on General Fordian, who is, as we said, Ross's protege. Who, ooh, ironically,
he's a character.
Yeah, it was funny. Back in the Red Hulk book days, he hunted the Red Hulk, not knowing that it was like his mentor all along.
Yeah.
Sucker. And we get to see his past a little bit and how he developed like his passion for the mission, and we see how he responded to opportunities and took advantage of them, and how this clandestine shadow base was formed in the, quite literally in the shadows of the Gamma base. Then we get treated to the further evolution of his character's path in Immortal Hulk style. Fordian, something happens to him. The next issue, 23, and I'm assuming right up to issue 25, which is often a benchmark issue in a title, this looks to be a biggie because everyone is converging on Fordian's position. You've got the Hulk, and Fordian is there, and the Betty, and Alpha Flight, or the Gamma Flight, Alpha Flight guys,
yeah,
all come in too. This is like the one we've been waiting for kind of thing about to happen. I love this title. It began really detached from the regular Marvel universe and kind of remote with like these little stories out in like Jerkwater, Nebraska or wherever. And now it's like right in the center of the Marvel U. I really like it.
So good, Steve.
And all the horror moments that we talked about on the previous episode, like him being cut up into pieces and in mason jars, but waking up and being able to wiggle his finger in the other jar, those horrific dramatic moments persist throughout these issues too, from the deaths of characters to their transformations and the extreme Hulk out that he does on that guy who has the hand that changes into different forms.
Oh.
And each issue, Kev, it ends with that, like, half splash page, and then you get the title of the story revealed as the last panel in each issue. And it's always something clever, sometimes even answering the last bit of dialogue. That, I mean, it doesn't do this exactly, but, I mean, it, just as an example, like, if the last thing a character said was knock, knock, the title would be revealed as who's there, you know, of the issue, something like that. That's, you know, time and effort and love is put into doing things like that, which is cool.
I don't know why I always recall this, but I remember there's a Fin Fang Foom story, and it was like called like Scale Model or something.
That's That's awesome.
It's always good.
So this book continues to be awesome, continues to, and I mean, I haven't given away anything of the those beats that make this book really shine, and the fact that the drama has been ramping up since the first issue, delivering each issue after issue, and now we're all the way up to issue 22, and I'm saying 23 looks like it's going to be the good one, the really good one. Wow, they've really are stringing me along here quite nicely. I haven't felt like this reading a Hulk book since the Bruce Jones, Mike Diodato stuff, where they made it all be shadowy and dark and a horror book, really.
Yeah, definitely has some, I don't know if you would say influence, but it's definitely, because you're taking things from all over, but yeah. And then some of that early Hulk stuff injected into the DNA.
It's fun. Definitely a thumbs up, top of the stack type of book. Definitely check it out on, now that there's been a lot of books in the can, go check it out on Marvel Unlimited. I'm sure there's plenty of issues there for you to enjoy.
They're also putting out some swanky hardcovers now of this.
Oversized, I hope.
Yeah, I think the usual size. The usual slightly over. Like, not super over. I think we have to specify now, because Marvel's put out some crazy monster, huge, like right. Twice, three up. What is it? Like, they're just ridiculous.
Well, they're probably like omnibus sized, but not thickness, but of but size, which is along the lines of those other Marvel premiere type things that they had for a while there. Very cool. I'm glad it still is as enjoyable title as it was the first bunch of issues in. Al Ewing, man, the last few books of his really, really knocked me off my feet.
Yeah, he's like becoming like a legitimate superstar, and I like, my eyes are always open for whatever he's doing.
And I love his the persona he presents in the letters pages in the back of the book too. He's definitely one of us. All right, thanks for tuning in for this episode of Marvel Noise. We will be back soon with more Marvel goodness to throw at you. Maybe some more New Warriors. How does that sound, Kevin?
That sounds awesome.
Got to keep feeding the New Warriors beast so we can get to the good issues, like I keep saying.
Sounds like a guy in the background looking at some kind of statue and holding a mug going, soon, soon.
All right, until the new Abomination is defeated in a facial thumb war, make mine Marvel. Later.